Thomas, thank you very much. And thank you for inviting me and to give the lecture, and welcome. And I hope all of you understand my English. I apologize for not speaking in French. Well, today I'm trying to give you a brief overview of what's new in the archaeology and understanding of the Philistines, and how in the last decade or so the picture of how we understand the Philistines has changed very much. And I will speak about it primarily based on the finds from my excavations at Tel Esafi, which Professor Romer mentioned just moments ago. Now, let's start with some of the basics. Who are the Philistines? Well, we all know of them from the biblical text, Samson and Delilah, David and Goliath, and all those stories, and they're very well known from antiquity, way before archaeology actually started. And for about the last century, there has been a lot of archaeological evidence of the Philistines, starting from the first archaeological excavations that were conducted in the land of Israel since the 19th century, including, as we'll see, the site of Tel Esafi, which is one of the major sites. Now, for many years, and I can say this as I remember, I was a student of Trude Dotan, Professor Trude Dotan from the Hebrew University, who is the grand lady of the Philistines, if you want. The story was very simple. It was a view of the Philistines coming in an invasion, sort of like the D-Day invasion on Normandy. They land on the coast, they take over the Canaanite cities, they create a new culture, which is brought from Mycenaean Greece, and they start going through a process in which, after a few centuries, they assimilate and disappear. And that's basically how we understood the Philistines for many, for a long time. And it's really time for a significant paradigm shift in this. And this is due to several things. One is new finds and new understandings, new analysis that are popping up, new interpretive directions. And this is also an important aspect, is that whole new ways of looking at the remains are now being brought up, which change our understanding. And it's always good to do this in science, is to reassess many of the assumptions that we assume just because we assume them and nothing else. And as I said, this will be based on mainly our finds from Tel Esafi. But let me start with a little background. Just about 1200 BCE, there occurred a major change in the Near East, which is perhaps one of the most substantial historical transitions in the ancient world. And this is the transition from what we call the Late Bronze Age, which was a period of approximately between 1500 and 1200, and the Iron Age, a period of approximately 1200 to 600, 586, or something of the sort. And what happened there is, during the Late Bronze Age, there was a world system of empires and diplomatic relations and trade and a very, very clear world order that was set up and lasted for 300 years about. And then just around 1200, starting a few years before, ending a few years afterwards, this whole system collapses. And one of the most interesting questions in the study of the ancient Near East is, what caused this collapse? And for many years, all kinds of suggestions have been put up. There, one suggestion was that there were a series of invasions. For example, the Sea Peoples, we'll talk about them in a moment, among them Philistines, the Israelites, the Arameans, other groups. Another explanation was migrations that destroyed the various countries, climate change, and all these have been, everybody has been trying to explain this in various manners, and perhaps, and this is, I would say, the way that most people look at it now, it's a complex set of reasons that have all moved together at the same time, which brought about a collapse. Now, this is not a collapse that occurred overnight, but rather a gradual process of about a century. And I always like to use the analogy, if you think of an archaeologist as a time traveler, and with that, a time traveler goes into the time tunnel and comes out in an earlier time. So if we would go into our time tunnel and come out about 1300, look around, go back in the time tunnel and come out again at 1100 BCE, 200 years later, the picture would be completely different. But it's not as if we could find one day in which it changed, but rather it's a protracted process. Now, at the very end of the 13th century and the beginning of the 12th century BCE, we start to see evidence of some of the new cultures, new peoples, and new causes for this change. And one of the most important are the evidence from the Egyptians of the Sea Peoples. The Sea Peoples are groups of people who probably came from somewhere in the eastern and central northern Mediterranean. That means Greece, western Anatolia, the Balkans, and perhaps Italy, and even farther to the west. And they're comprised of different groups. The most famous of the groups are the Philistines. And these groups are mentioned, among other places, in the inscriptions and reliefs of the temple at Medina Tabu of Ramses III, which dates to more or less 1180 BCE, in which Ramses III tells us that he fought a land and a sea battle against the Philistines and the other sea peoples. And you can see here the battles and the prisoner sea peoples who are being paraded at the end of the battle. And these people, according to the Egyptians, were forced to settle in Canaan along the coast and serve as a military garrison for the Egyptians. Now, how does this fit in with what we know? So if we look at the picture of the Mediterranean at the at this time, we can see that there are several major cultures. There's the Hittite culture in the northeast, the Egyptian culture in the southeast, the Canaanite culture in what the area which would be Israel, Syria, Jordan, Lebanon of today. And towards the west, we have the Aegean cultures, primarily the Mycenaean cultures, and all kinds of other cultures that are further afield to the north and to the west. Now, all these various cultures apparently were part of this phenomenon that we call the Sea Peoples. And as opposed to what was very often thought, that the Sea Peoples were people who got on the boats in Piraeus, traveled along the Mediterranean, landed along the coast, and took over the entire coast, destroying the cities. Again, the idea of the Normandy invasion, in which you have the Philistines in the south, the Chardonnay in the north, the various groups taking over different areas. That was the picture for many, many years. But this has changed. And why has this changed? Is because when we start looking at the various groups of the Sea Peoples, we can see several very distinct differences. For example, the Philistines are well known, and the Philistines, according to the biblical text, but also according to the archaeological remains, settle in the area of what we would call today the southern coastal plain of Israel. That would be between Tel Aviv and Gaza, more or less. And this is a region which, both in the biblical text and in the archaeological remains, we can find the various groups of the Philistines. Now, if there are other groups of sea peoples, we would expect a similar pattern also in the north. But when we look for other groups of sea peoples who were mentioned by the Egyptians, we have no clear archaeological evidence of this, so except perhaps in very, very northern Syria. So we have, first of all, already another change. Then another thing goes on is that when we start looking at the archaeological remains, and I'll speak about this in detail soon, is that if we thought that the Philistines all came from one region, then we would expect that the material culture, their archaeological remains, would be typical of one region, the region from where they came from. And when we start looking at the archaeological remains, we see that it's a very eclectic culture. It's a culture which combines foreign elements from many areas, along with local elements, all combined into a term that we're using now, an entangled culture. That means a culture that's mixed together. It's not a monolithic culture. Now, another very interesting thing is just about the time that the Philistines are settling in the southern coastal plain, there's another group of people who are settling in the central hills. And these are, of course, the early Israelites. Now, up until the discovery of the archaeological remains of the Philistines, what we knew about the Philistines, except for brief mentions in Egyptian sources, was from the Bible. Now, the vision of the Philistines, our understanding of the Philistines through the Bible, is from the Israelite side. And it's clearly, if we would have a Philistine Bible, we would have a very different picture of what went on. And imagine if we thought about the first Gulf War, and we read what happened in the Gulf War in the New York Times or in the Baghdad Times, we would get a very different picture. So the same thing goes for here. We have an image of the Philistines from the biblical text, but it's most probably a very ideologically slanted depiction of these people. So now, because of that, going to the archaeological remains, to a certain extent, lets us look beyond or underneath the story, underneath the ideology, and try to understand some of the details and the complexity of the story. So as I said, we thought that they were monolithic origin from the Mycenaean, arrive in Canaan and conquer Canaanite cities, replacing the Canaanites, and then for 200 years or so, they had a very, very foreign type of culture, and then they quickly assimilated into the local culture and disappeared. And all this, it has to change. And another very important point, and this is vis-a-vis the biblical text, is that according to the biblical text, from the time of David and Solomon, the Judahite and later the United Judahite Kingdom was dominant over the Philistines. And that from the 10th century, from around 1000, the Philistines were under the control of the Judahite kingdom. And one of the things that we'll see is that the archaeological remains seem to clearly indicate that that's not the case. Okay, so let's start with Tel Asafi. So that marks off the five cities of the Philistine Pentapolis, the five major cities, Gaza, Ashkelon, Ashdod, and Ekron, and Tel Asafi we're dealing with. And Tel Asafi is located on the border between what we would call Philistia, the southern coastal plain, and what's known as the Judean foothills, or in Hebrew, the Shephelah. And the Shephelah is a region which, both in biblical times but in other times, is a transition zone between the coastal plain and the central hills. And by the way, if you think of the stories about the Philistines in the biblical text, most of these stories occur in the Shephelah. Why? Because when the Philistines were strong, they pushed east. When the Israelites were strong, they pushed west. And this seesaw relationship is seen in the archaeological remains. Now, here you can see a view looking west towards the sea, Gaza and Ashkelon, and there is Tel Asafi. And you can see here that Tel Asafi is right on the border between the edge, the western edge of the Shephelah, and the beginning of the coastal plain. Now, one of the problems with the study of the site of Gath of the Philistines is, of the five cities of the Philistine Pentapolis, the only city whose name that was retained till the 19th, 20th century, the Arabic name, Tel Asafi, has nothing to do with the name Gath. All the other cities, Ashkelon, Gaza, Ashdod, Ekron, their name told us that that was the original city. So from the mid-19th century, people started trying to place on the map where Gath is. And so they tried all kinds of different places. Someone once told me the question is not which sites have been identified as God, but why have sites not been identified as God? Yeah. And so you can see here, there really was quite a problem. And for over a century, there was a lively discussion in the literature where God was. And in fact, when I started my excavation in 1996, there were still people who were saying, well, maybe Tel Asafi is the site, but we're not sure. Now, unfortunately, we have not yet found the site Welcome to God. But the archaeological remains seem to indicate that this, in fact, is the site, that we have all what we expect to have and all that we shouldn't have if this is God. So we can be quite sure that we can put this discussion into the history of research. It's not relevant anymore. And Tel Asafi is one of the largest ancient sites, one of the largest pre-classical sites in Israel. And you can see here views of the upper tell from various various directions. And one of the important features on the site is you can see here these white chalk cliffs. And this is the what gave the name to the site in its Arabic name. Tel Asafi in Arabic means something like the pure mound. And very often, sites which have something white on them, they have that title for it. Okay, so here's a view, an aerial photograph of the excavations and a plan of the excavations with the various areas. And here's a close-up view. And I will be speaking about various areas, but I'll just point out some of the more important. Most of the excavations are on the eastern side. Then we have an excavations on the summit. And this is a very interesting situation. We wanted to excavate on the actual summit because there's a Crusader castle over here. And we would assume that below the Crusader castle, we would have found the palaces of earlier periods. But unfortunately, this whole area is covered over by a modern Muslim cemetery, so we didn't excavate, but we excavated close to it. We excavated in the lower city, which I'll speak about as well, and it turns out that during the Iron Age, the city reaches its largest size. If during most periods it was about 12 hectares, during the Iron Age II, the 10th and 9th century, it reaches about 50 hectares. So it's a very large site, and we want to excavate over here, and we've excavated a burial zone over here. And of course, I'll speak about this soon, a very, very impressive siege system which surrounds the site. And I'll tell you about it at the end, so don't fall asleep. Now, I don't know if you can see this even, but this gives you a nice idea of the stratigraphy, the layers from the various periods. And as you know, in an archaeological tell, it's one layer on top of another, each representing a different period. And I will be speaking about primarily the Iron Age. That's the period of about 1200 to 586. And that's the period where at Tel Asafi we have the Philistine remains. Okay, so now, when we first, right at the beginning of the Iron Age, we can see major changes in the material culture. But these changes are different from what often was assumed, because if we assume that the Philistines came, landed in Canaan, destroyed the Canaanite cities, and took them over, and then started their new culture, we would expect to see layers of destruction. And in all the Philistine sites, we don't have destruction layers. We have maybe a building here, a building there, but there aren't clear-cut destruction layers throughout the site. And so this means that when the Philistines arrived, and we can see the changes in the material culture, they didn't destroy the existing Canaanite site. And when we start looking at the remains, we see something very interesting. On the one hand, we see certain aspects, and this is an example of the pottery coming from the early Philistine layers, which are clearly non-local pottery, very similar to pottery that we will find in the Mycenaean world at this time. And this is called Mycenaean 3C pottery. And this is clearly an indication that people among the Philistines had with them traditions of foreign origin. They weren't local traditions. And in fact, the traditions were so that they even brought with them new types of cooking vessels. And as we all know, and I don't have to say, I don't have to reiterate this when I'm in Paris, that food is a very, very central part of our of your cultural definition. And as we can see here, a very basic aspect of the Philistine identity was connected to new ways of cooking food, eating food, preparing food, etc. And we'll return to this in a moment. But at the same time, we can find a Philistine house where you will have non-local cooking vessels and other vessels, and at, right next to it, a Canaanite cooking vessel. So it means that most probably the Philistines came to these cities, settled in these cities, but lived side by side with the Canaanites, and perhaps even intermarrying in them. And this is, again, a very different picture from what we've had in the past. Now, one of the things that we see, and this is the classical decorated Philistine pottery, is that with time, the Philistines start the non-local aspects of the Philistine culture start changing, and they become more and more combined with all kinds of local things. So, for example, if we look at these vessels, this is what we call a bell-shaped crater. It's clearly related to the Mycenaean bell-shaped craters, but what they've done here is they've started decorating them differently. And these decorations are very much influenced from the local Canaanite decorations. Another interesting feature that appears very often in the Philistine decorated pottery, you can see here is the bird. And this probably is a depiction of the Philistine goddess, who, and the main deity of the Philistine, we know from the Bible, is Dagon. They often assume that it's a male god, but most probably Dagon was actually a female god. And this is probably a depiction of this goddess. Now, another very interesting thing, and this is something that's been known for quite a while, but nowadays we understand this much better, is that in the change of food, it wasn't only how you prepare your food, but also what types of food you eat. And one of the things that we see in many of the Philistine cities is that there's evidence that they were eating pig meat and dog meat. And how do we see this? We see the bones, and also you see butchery marks on the bones. Now, this, in recent years, has turned into the way of defining between Israelites and Philistines. Supposedly, the Philistines ate pig, the Israelites didn't eat pig. And if that is so, this is perhaps the earliest evidence of what we would call the kashrut, the Jewish dietary laws, which eventually developed into many other things. Every time I tell this, I have to tell a joke, you'll excuse me. There's Moses comes up to the to Mount Sinai, and he and God says to him, "Thou shalt not cook an ewe in its mother's milk." And so he says, "Does that mean we have to wait 6 hours between milk and meat?" He says, "No, thou shalt not cook an ewe in its mother's milk." "Does that mean we need two sets of dishes?" "Oh, do whatever you want to." Anyway, back to the pigs and the Philistines. So for many years, it was thought that here we have, if you have a site with pig bones, it's Philistine. If you have a site without pig bones, it's Israelite. Seemingly very nice, but it's much more complicated. And one of the things that we've started noticing in Philistia is that in urban sites, you have pig bones. In rural sites, you don't have pig bones. And when you go to the Israelites, in Judah, you don't have pig bones. In Israel, you do have pig bones. So things are a little more complicated than we have assumed. And like always, things are not black or white, they're gray. Now, another very interesting thing that came out, though, we recently did a DNA study, an ancient DNA study of pig bones from various sites in the land of Israel from before, during, and after the Iron Age. And one of the things that came out is that you can differentiate between the genome of the pigs from Europe as opposed to pigs from the Near East. And one of the things that we see is that if we look at the present day genome of pigs in the Middle East, you can see that they appear in this area. When we start looking at the pigs and their genome in this area, they have a European haplotype. So what this means, and this change occurred at the beginning of the Iron Age. So what this means is the Philistines, when they came from wherever they came, from wherever they came from, they brought with them squealing pigs in their ships, on their carts, and these pigs, after having landed and been set up in the Philistine cities, escaped into the wild and eventually mated with the local boars, the wild pigs, and eventually the European pigs took over as from a genetic point of view in this region. And this is a fascinating aspect because we can see here evidence of what's known today as invasion biology, where a species takes over from another species, from a local species, through a very clearly human originating change. Another interesting point, again connected to food, is types of plants that are used. And it's been known for quite a while that there are one or two types of plants that are common in Greece and the Aegean and first appear with the Philistines. And this has been known for quite many years, but recently we did a very in-depth study of all the plants that have been found on archaeological excavations in the land of Israel and the surrounding areas, with a focus on Philistia, both during the late Bronze Age, Iron Age, and later. And one of the things that we can see is that the types of plants in Philistia that appear when the Philistines culture first appears are not just one or two new types, but rather there is a complete change in the agrarian practices. One, that's important, and that's, again, a very important thing is when a culture comes, if agrarian practices change, that tells us a lot about a major change. Another interesting thing is that the various plants that appear don't originate from one place, but originate from throughout the Eastern Mediterranean. So again, hints that the Philistines were not comprised of one group coming from one place, but various groups coming from various areas mixing together. And one of the things that we can say about cooking, so we mentioned the cooking jug, and one of the aspects that appear when the Philistine culture first appears are hearths, cooking fireplaces, as opposed to the typical way that Canaanites and Israelites were cooked in what we call a tabun or a tanur, which is a clay oven, which is still used today in the Middle East. When the Philistine culture arrives, we see for 200-300 years the use of a hearth, of a fireplace. And they apparently place them, the cooking pots, on the fireplace. Now, this is typical of Philistia. And interestingly, after several centuries, this disappears. But the Philistine cooking jug, which first appears in Philistia, starts appearing then in the local cultures. That means in Judah, in Israel, in Phoenicia, at this time, we start seeing the appearance of these jugs. That means that the changes in the cuisine and the way of preparing food that the Philistines brought with them influences the other cultures as well. So that means that it's not only that the Philistines are slowly becoming more and more Levantine, but the Philistines are also influencing the cultures outside of Philistia. And if you can imagine, someone from Judah came to Gat, and they served him tzatziki. And he said, oh, I like that. So he went home and says, OK, I'll prepare it. We have to prepare it in the right type of vessels. OK. Now, this can be seen also not only in the macro, but also in the micro. And one of the things that we have been focusing on a lot at our excavations is implementing what we call microarchaeology in the field. That means using a wide array of analytic techniques, scientific analytic techniques, to understand the past. Not only excavating the things, putting them in a box, and sending them to the laboratory, but bringing the scientists into the field. And one of the things that we found, that when we excavated this, what looks like a very, very simple plaster surface, these two surfaces in a room, and we excavate many of these throughout the in many countries and many cultures and many times, etc. But when this was analyzed, it turned out that this was a plaster that's a very specific type of plaster. It's what's known as hydraulic plaster. Hydraulic plaster is a type of plaster that hardens in an anaerobic environment. That means it hardens underwater. You don't need exposure to the environment, to air, for it to harden. Most plaster does require exposure to air. And now, hydraulic plaster is one of the typical aspects of Roman architecture. The way Romans built bridges was by pouring hydraulic cement into molds under the water, and they would harden under the water. Now, it turns out, though, that hydraulic cement was and plaster was used and known beforehand. And interestingly, this is the first example of hydraulic plaster from Levant in the Iron Age and Bronze Age, but it's known in the Mycenaean and Minoan culture. So this is an example of a hidden type of cultural technological influence that we can see through the archaeological remains. And this is what I was speaking about, is that as opposed to the past, when we would take the finds, something interesting, you put them in a box, you send it to the lab, you get the answer weeks, months, years afterwards. And sometimes the answers are very important, but sometimes you'll be in a situation where the scientist will say, well, it's this or that, I think you should go back and check it. But if you've excavated it years ago, you can't go back and check it. And here, what we're doing is we actually have the scientists in the field. So when things of interest are found, we can get at least preliminary analyses right on the spot. And then you can start changing the way you work in the field, changing your tactics, and changing your understanding, and have a deeper understanding already in the field. And this is, it's not an easy thing, because you have to have 10, 15, 20 people of different disciplines working together. And I don't know if there are scientists here, but people from the hard sciences, their wiring is different from people in the humanities and social sciences. So it's not always easy to get everybody to think together at the same time, but we managed to do it. And we have some very, very interesting results. And in fact, we have some results that without the scientists being in the field, we would have missed altogether. Okay, so let's go on now. Now, in the area of the main excavation, which we call Area A on the eastern side, we found a very interesting structure, which I'll mark off over here. And this structure is, in fact, what seems to be a temple. Now, here you can see the walls of the temple, only partially preserved on this side, but you can see it well preserved over here. And right in the center of the temple, you have two pillar bases, which are just about four cubits between one another. And of course, you can reconstruct two pillars. Now, what's interesting about that? I'm sure you all know the story of Samson. Now, this doesn't mean that Samson stood in this temple and knocked the pillars down, but perhaps this is an indication that whoever wrote the story of Samson, whether it's based on any historical evidence or whether it's a complete a fictional story, he perhaps knew what a Philistine temple looked like. So that when he described the Philistine temple, he described a temple which would have fit in with the story if the story had occurred. Another interesting story, and this is here another example of how we're changing our understanding, is for many, many years, it was assumed that since the Philistines came from the Mycenaean culture, the Philistines, and when they first arrived, spoke some sort of language like Mycenaean Greek, And they said, Goliath, that's a name that that's Indo-European, perhaps Greek. Achish is like Achaios, a Greek word. And there's all kinds of other words that they, for example, and they use the word, the term for the Philistine leader is Seren. So it was compared to Tyrannos. And they said, there, we just have to find the Philistine inscriptions, and we'll be able to decipher the Philistine language, and we'll know from what they came from. So first of all, we've been excavating Philistia for 120 years or something like that, 140 years. And so far, we have not found any archives. I'm willing to find an archive. I promise you, I won't mind finding a Philistine archive. But chances are, there are no Philistine archives. Why? Because writing does not, in the antiquity, does not exist in a vacuum. And for example, writing in the Aegean existed only when they were as a palace-based society. Once the palace-based society of the late Bronze Age fell apart, a little after 1200, there was no writing in the Aegean until the Phoenician alphabet reached the Greeks somewhere in the 10th, 9th, 8th century, depending on the various views. So for several centuries, there was no writing in Aegean. So there is no reason to assume that even if the Philistines were from the Mycenaean culture, that they would have brought the Mycenaean Greek, both language and writing systems, from there to Philistia. So when we do find various inscriptions, which may be inscriptions which tell us something about the Philistine writing and the Philistine language, we see a very mixed lot. So for example, there's an inscription from Ashkelon, which has been interpreted as Cypro-Minoan. That's very nice. The only problem is nobody knows how to read Cypro-Minoan, so we don't know what it says. Then there's been an inscription that was found at Afik, which is in the northern Philistia, which looks like an Aegean-type writing, but it's not any of the known ones. So even if it is an Aegean-style writing system, it belongs to something that we don't even know what it is. And then finally, we found an inscription in Tel Asafi from the 10th century, which here, though, it's already written in archaic alphabetic letters, but it probably gives two names, two Indo-European names. So what you probably have here is evidence that also in language and writing, the Philistines were a mixed lot. They had various foreign influences coming in, and at the same time, within a century or two, started using the local alphabetic script for their writing. So we have here a very complex process going on throughout several centuries. Now, this said, I can promise you that I still won't mind this summer finding an archive of Philistine inscriptions. So if I'm proven wrong, I'd be very happy. Now, a very interesting find, and this is the here, I just showed everybody the this is the t-shirt I just got for Thomas here, yes, two years ago, we found, we excavated a complete ivory bowl from an early Philistine level, updated about to the 11th century, and you can see here it's quite well preserved. This is after it came out. We didn't excavate the bowl in the field, we rather excavated a whole block of sediment in one piece, took it to the lab, and in the conservation lab, they excavated the bowl, and it turned out it's a bowl made out of elephant ivory. And you can see here it has a very nice decoration on the inside and on the outside, and it has several holes you can see here, which were originally for a cover. The cover would fit in perfectly on the top. Now, we know it's elephant ivory, and one of the most fascinating things is that soon after its discovery, it turned out that at Megiddo, in the excavations conducted by the University of Chicago in the 1920s and 30s, they found a cache of late Bronze Age ivories that were found in an underground room in the last palace of the Canaanite king of Megiddo, which was destroyed somewhere in the early 11th century BCE or late 12th century BCE. And in this cache, there were several hundred items, including a group of bowls which are virtually identical to the bowl that we found. And I was in Chicago about a year ago, and I held several of these bowls that they found, and it looked as if it was made by the same person. And I had the feeling that it was as if there was a tusk of ivory, and they cut slices off, and they made a bowl after bowl after bowl. Now, we've checked this, and it turns out modern science to help. There's a very, very extensive database of isotope analysis of ivory that's used today by the World Wildlife Foundation to try to stop elephant poaching. And so they can identify where elephants come throughout Africa and throughout the Southeast Asia. And this can be used also, and we're checking this, to identify the origins of where the ivory is coming, but also perhaps to tell you, are two bowls from the same tusk? And so far, it seems that the two bowls that we've tested, ours and one of the Megiddo ones, are not from the same tusk. But hopefully, we will test this in the future, and maybe we'll be able to see how many of the bowls are made from the same tusk, how many not, and where the ivory comes from. In any case, what is very special here is what you have here is an ivory cache of Canaanite origin. And this clearly depicts a Canaanite cultural milieu. But in Ghat, you find one of these. So somehow, one of these objects moved from the Canaanite surroundings into the so-called Philistine surroundings, meaning that the cultural connections between the various cultures in this region were very, very close. And elite objects were moving between the various parts. Now, moving on, perhaps one of the most interesting aspects of our excavation throughout the 20 years that we've been working is the remains of a destruction level, which dates to the 9th century. And wherever we excavated, we found remains of a destroyed city. I see I'm a little late here. Should I? I can go on? Yeah, okay, no problems, yeah. Okay, okay. And wherever we excavated, we found hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of vessels that were found in houses that had collapsed during a destruction of the city. And this event is almost Pompeian, that you have a moment in the history of the city in which we're frozen in time. And wherever we excavated, we found every different type of vessel that you can imagine, from serving vessels, cooking vessels, and cultic vessels. And one of the very interesting things that have come out is on these chalices, we conducted what's known as organic residue analysis. This is a new technique in which organic remains very often decompose. And if I would have a cup full of olive oil, the olive oil would not survive. But it turns out that organic molecules, and particularly lipids, go into the matrix of the ceramics and survive. And in certain cases, you can actually identify what was in the original vessel. And one of the things that turned out is that these vessels were used for incense, for burning incense. And some of the components of this incense from these and other chalices like this were very interesting. It turns out that they were using cinnamon and nutmeg. Now, cinnamon and nutmeg come from Sri Lanka and the region around Sri Lanka. So that means at 1000 BCE, there was trade between the Indian subcontinent and the Levant. Now, it's not someone didn't get on an airplane and fly to Colombo. It was a down-the-line trade that eventually reached the area. But it means that the cultural and world and the trade connection world of the ancient Levant is much wider and much broader than we often assume. And again, this doesn't mean, but for example, if you think of the story of the Queen of Sheba, the natural inclination to take a story like the Queen of Sheba is, well, that couldn't be. How could anybody in Israel be connected with Yemen? Now, I'm not saying that that necessarily occurred, but what we do have to think is that very often our vision of the ancient world is an enclosed vision. We have to think, and it seems this to hint to it, that things could be much broader and more expansive than we very often let ourselves think. Okay, so now moving on. Here we have the upper city, the upper tell, and this is the part of the tell that was settled in most periods. And what it turned out in our survey, when we started the site, we started the excavations, we surveyed, we picked up material remains from the surface. It turned out that the city during the 10th and 9th century BC was much larger than all other periods. In fact, it was 45 to 50 hectares in size, which made it one of the largest sites in Israel in pre-classical times. Now, if this is the case, and Gat was the largest city in Canaan during the 10th and 9th century, this clearly tells us something very, very important about the role of Gat vis-a-vis the other kingdoms, the other groups in Canaan. Now, if Gat is 45 to 50 hectares in size and is not destroyed during the 10th century and is only destroyed at the end of the 9th century, which I'll talk about in a moment, it means that it seems that the Judeans never took over, never controlled, never destroyed, and never diminished the power of the kingdom of Gat during the 10th and 9th century, the time of David, Solomon, and the immediate kings right after that. So this means that the archaeological evidence seems to indicate a different understanding of the role and the importance of the Canaanite, of the Philistine kingdoms during that period. And we excavated in the lower city, and this is one of the areas of excavation. You can see here, right below surface, we started finding remains from the Iron Age IIa, and this includes, as you can see here, one modern building, a very large area which dates to the 9th century and which was also destroyed, but below it, and this is very important, a substantial layer in purple dating to the 10th century. So again, the lower city of Gat, the extensive size of Gat, existed during the 10th and 9th century BCE. And here you can see, for example, the various lower levels, and this is an interesting find from one of the lower levels, a group of cultic objects, what we call the votive objects, and among others, we found a seashell, a complete seashell of a type that's found in the Mediterranean. You have to dive quite deeply to get it, but it's a known Mediterranean seashell. But what's interesting is this is a type of, of seashell which is used for cultic purposes in the Minoan and the Mycenaean culture. So this seems to be a tradition that is kept in the Philistine culture 200-300 years after they arrive. Moving on to the red, here we see evidence of the same destruction which I mentioned before, but very interestingly, we found right over here an altar which is very, very unique. This altar, you can see, is made out of one stone block. It's 50 centimeters by 50 centimeters by a meter high, which would, if we turn it into cubits, it's a cubit by 2 cubits high. It has decorations which are similar to the decorations which are seen on other Israelite Judite altars, and by the way, the biblical description. But what's different here is that it has two horns and not four horns. The two in the back, there were never horns. And this is very, very interesting because if we look at the depiction of one of the altars in the tabernacle, here we have the same dimensions. Now again, this doesn't mean that this is the altar from the tabernacle, or that the altar of the tabernacle even existed for it. We can't prove that. What it does mean is that the Philistine and Israelite cultic background in the Philistine cultic background, that dimension was of importance, one by one by two. Now, another thing is the fact that it has a similar shape, but a different shape. It doesn't have four horns. And if we look at the typical Israelite altar, this is a typical Israelite, in this case from Megiddo. You can see here the four horns. But if you take off the two back horns, this is very similar to the altar that we found. But interestingly, in Cyprus, we find altars with two horns. So this very object is probably, the object itself is an entangled object. You have a combination of Western and Eastern traditions coming together in the same object. And when it comes to cultic objects, cult is very often an excellent place where you can see the intermixture of different influences at a very, very important part of life. Right next to the altar, we found a very interesting chalk figurine, which the zoologist claims that it's a dog. I don't see a dog here, but I believe the zoologist. We found here another one of those beautiful chalices and two vessels with inscriptions. This vessel is fascinating because it's a inscription on a jar about this size, which has on it an Israelite name or a Judite name, Avtam or Avitam or something of the sort. The jar is made was made in the Jerusalem area. It's made out of mozza clay. That means the clay from the vicinity of Jerusalem. So that means a Judite from the Jerusalem area took a jar from the Jerusalem area, dedicated it with his name, and gave it in at a Philistine temple. Which is very interesting, because if we think of the biblical understanding of what's going on between the Philistines, these are enemies. And here we see that there's a lot more closer connections. Okay, so going back to the destruction, I won't go into all the details, but who made this, who caused this horrible destruction? And this is apparently Hazael, king of Aram Damascus. And we know this, there's a very, very brief mention in 2 Kings 12, 18 or 17, depending on the version, in which he says he came up to Gath, he fought against it and took it. And then he goes on to Jerusalem, and the rest of the story deals with Jerusalem. And this is a very nice example of the use of the biblical text for history. The biblical text is not telling history. It's telling the ideological understanding of Jerusalem and the Davidic dynasty. And if it can mention within the story something that is relevant that's not related to Jerusalem, so it may do that. In this case, they mention Gath. And if we wouldn't know about this destruction if the biblical text hadn't given us half a passage about it. And we can see this remains of the destruction, as I saw throughout the excavations and all the destroyed houses. But most interestingly, we can see, and I already noted this, a very interesting feature that surrounds the site on the eastern, southern, and western side. Here you can see the actual till. You can see it here as well. And as we now know, this element attached up to the riverbed here. So basically, it surrounded the site in four directions. And what this is a circumvallation. It's a siege system. Some of you, I'm sure, I usually say at Masada, but if we're in France, so we have an example of a siege system, a circumvallatio, from the not from the Roman period, the first centuries BC or the fourth century CE, but rather from 800 BC, the earliest siege system known in the world today. And it's comprised of a deep trench that was dug out into the bedrock. The material was poured out on the side, and you can see here, this is an artist reconstruction of what it would have looked like. And you can see here the siege trench, a wall built along it, here and there a tower, and it surrounds the city. And basically, the Arameans waited until the people became hungry and thirsty, and eventually attacked the city and destroyed it. We don't have the actual evidence of the breaking into the wall, but the results are quite clear. Now, a very interesting parallel to this was found in an Aramaic inscription that was found in northern Syria at the beginning of the 20th century. It's known as the Zakur inscription. And in the Zakur inscription, you can see here, this is the a drawing of the inscription, which was found by a Frenchman. I don't know if this was, I haven't seen it. It's supposedly in the Damascus Museum. I don't know if it still exists anymore. Oh, it's in the Louvre? Oh. So there, this afternoon I will look at it. Thank you, Professor Lemire. there you go. So there you go. It's even more relevant. And there it says in Aramaic, and he's this is Bir-Hadad, the son of Hazael, the same Hazael which we relate to it. It says he describes how a group of Aramean kings attacked his city, the city of Hadrach, and besieged it. And then it says, they raised a wall higher than the wall of Hadrach, and they dug a ditch deeper than its ditch. So perhaps, and this is what we suggest, is this is the same type of siege system. This is mentioned in an inscription. We have it on the ground, and for many years I was hoping that peace with Syria would come, between Israel and Syria would come, and I'd be able to go to Hadrach, Tel Afis, and check this out. It doesn't look like it's going to happen for a while. Next. Gat is destroyed. Hazael destroys the city completely, and the city is basically abandoned. And we can see, in fact, that after this destruction, Gat stops being a Philistine city. And instead, we have some very interesting phenomena. And what we have here, and you can see here very nicely, is that this is one of the areas where we find the 9th century destruction layer. If we would dig below that, and we have dug in below that, you find all the many, many vessels that I showed you beforehand. Now, right above that, you can see in the section, there's this this block of material, which is in fact a brick collapse. And in between the two, we have evidence of what we call a windblown sediment. That means that between the time of the destruction of the 9th century city and the time that those bricks collapsed, the wind blew dust for several years and created a layer of dust, which tells us that there was a period of time between this and this. Now, right above it, there are two 8th century destruction levels. And in these destruction levels, we have not Philistine material, but Judahite material. So that means that sometime in the 8th century, the people at Gat were oriented not to Philistia, but to Judah. Now, this is very interesting because we know from the biblical texts and from the Assyrian texts that in the second half of the 8th century, the Judahite kingdom tried to expand westwards into the Shephelah and into Philistia. And this seems to be one of the places where we can see this. Now, the Assyrians didn't accept this, and in 713 and in 701, the Assyrian campaigns pushed the Judahites back into the central hills. But this seems to be evidence of this. But here we have, though, several sequences which tell us something very interesting, because this what we might have here is destruction level, abandonment, an earthquake, and then two Judahite levels. And if we have an earthquake, and this is how we understand this earthquake, this is a wall, the stone foundation of a wall. On it, there was a brick superstructure. This brick superstructure, during an earthquake, was pushed to the north. And then there was a second. In earthquakes, there's always two waves of energy. There's a horizontal wave, and then let's call it a wavy wave, or the S wave, which usually hits a couple of seconds later. And so very often, buildings will be pushed off and then collapse. in two quick events, energy forces. And so what we have here is that it seems that the brick superstructure was pushed off the wall, and then it collapsed to the side. And each one of these is a brick that collapsed. Now, if this is the case, and then we have evidence of this occurring somewhere after the 9th century destruction level, but before the late 8th century, perhaps this hints to the well-known earthquake that's mentioned in the book of Amos, chapter 1, verse 1, the so-called, in Hebrew, Shnataim Lifnei Harash, 2 years before the earthquake. It's hinted to also in Zechariah. And again, even though that is more or less from the same time, this is centuries later, this may be a very, very distinct memory, also in Isaiah, of a substantial event that occurred sometime in the 8th century BCE. And this is important because not only did it affect Jerusalem, but if the earthquake could have such a devastating effect in Philistia, which would be west, substantially to the west of the epicenter, the earthquake's epicenter, clearly which was in the Jordan Valley, so this earthquake, or the earthquakes actually, that occurred in the 8th century, were of substantial influence on the Judahite kingdom, the Israelite kingdom at the time. And here we can see, after the earthquake, evidence of the Judahite occupation with typical Judahite houses, and this is evidence of the attempt of the Judahites to take over this region. And then the story at Gat ends for a century, but then if we go to the other Philistine sites, such as at Ashkelon, we can see the continuation of the Philistine story, in which the Philistine cities continue to exist till 604, till Nebuchadnezzar, the Babylonian king, destroys the final cities and exiles all the Philistines out of Philistia to Mesopotamia. So, let's go back to the original question. So, we know that the Philistine culture begins to form during the Late Bronze Age transition. What we now know, though, is these are various groups from the West, not one group, but a whole amalgamation of groups who are coming from the West, settling in Canaan with the Canaanites to form what we call an entangled culture. And in fact, we have recently even written, which I always wanted to be a pirate, so we can do this now, is one of the possibilities is some of the Philistines may actually have been pirate-like groups. And if you understand and you see the collapse of the society that occurred in the end of the Late Bronze Age, Iron Age transition, the existence of pirate-like groups is very, very logical. This change we see is a slow, gradual change, but very, very important. Throughout the Iron Age, they retain their unique cultural identity. That means that at the end of the Iron Age, if you would come up to a man from Ashkelon, he would identify himself as an Ashkelonite and as a Philistine. He wouldn't identify himself as, oh, I'm a Canaanite, I'm a Levantine. He would have a very clear cultural identity even till the end of the Iron Age. And most importantly is that the picture that we have when we read the biblical text, the, let's call it the pshat, the simple reading, when we read the biblical depiction of the Philistines and the Israelites, we see two enemies, two people fighting each other. But if you even, without the archaeological evidence, you go to the Samson narratives, he marries a couple of Philistines, he goes to Philistine weddings, he goes to a Philistine prostitute in Gaza, he takes there's a lot more going on than just fighting. And the archaeological remains show us that it's on many, many levels, and that the influences are going in both directions. And so that we have to understand this vision of the Israelites as the ultimate enemies of the Philistines and vice versa, as an ideological construct that is very different from the actual historical picture that was, you know, that we can see from the archaeological remains. And of course, Samson is a good allegory. And also, if you want, the Israelis and the Palestinians today are a very good allegory to that, because we supposedly are, I mean, Israelis and Palestinians, we're enemies. We fight each other, but on the end, we eat the same food, we dress the same clothes, we have very similar jokes, etc., etc. And finally, they disappear, the Philistines, really at the end of the Iron Age, when the Babylonians deport them to Mesopotamia, and within a century or two, they completely assimilate into the Mesopotamian surroundings. And around 400, there are no people who claim that they are Philistines. There's nobody who will say, "Oh, I am a Philistine." Okay, so then all I have to do is now ask you to all come and dig with me. So please, if you want to have an experience of your lifetime, please come and join us. We'll be in the field in July. And if you have any questions, you can look up my blog. And if you don't want to come, and you could follow the blog during the excavation, I have updates what's going on. And thank you very much.
Thank you very much, merci beaucoup. Le temps est un peu avancé, je crois on va terminer ici. Si vous avez des questions, vous pouvez vous approcher du professeur Meir, mais je dois aussi faire quelque chose de rituel. Je dois lui remettre, I have to give you the medal of the Collège de France.
Thank you.
And thank you very much again.
Do I have to wear it around my... No, thank you very much. Thank you.